Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, it's still a more realistic look at how computers worked in the 90s than Swordfish. This is Virtuosity. Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
We are not a podcast about bad movies. We are a podcast about movies that did badly.
That's right.
I'm John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like Virtuosity, which we're talking about today. But before we get into that, Ian, how are you holding up?
Can't believe I waited 4 years to try it out, but I finally got the COVID. It sucks, and I'm really tired. My blood oxygen is fine. I've been tracking that because I'm like an old school guy. Back in the day, you used to have to do that when you thought you had COVID. This COVID that they got now, it didn't destroy my lungs the way the original one used to do. So I'm thankful for that, but it sapped all my strength. I've done almost nothing but lie in bed for a couple weeks now. And sadly, it turns out when you act like a person with depression, you start feeling like one too. So now I'm trying to dig myself out of both a physical and emotional dumps right now. Hopefully podcasting is the cure for all of that.
I would say it can't hurt. You know,
no.
You're up and about, you're talking about probably one of your favorite movies ever.
Gets my blood flowing.
Getting all boomery about COVID, like, back in my day. Isn't it sad that we can be like, remember the old school COVID? That shit was crazy.
Like, it is sad.
We talk about it like it's Four Loko. Like, original recipe COVID was something else, man.
It's twisted. But I'm glad the current recipe is less life-threatening, to me at least. I don't want to diminish anyone else's experience, but I seem to be surviving it. I just wish I had more strength, but I'm going to give it time.
I wish you had more time. Sorry, that's one of my favorite Denzel line deliveries from Man on Fire.
Yeah.
It seemed appropriate given today's movie.
It's a Denzel week for us.
It is a Denzel week, but we can't talk about him too much. We got to get into show and tell first. So what did you watch this week or in any of the weeks past while you were laying about?
We managed to get the show restarted just before the Oscars. So I'm like, let me watch some Oscar-related stuff. I've been trying to catch as many of the Best Picture nominees as possible. And one of them that I watched this week was a little movie called Poor Things.
Oh, yeah.
By Yorgos Lanthimos. It stars Emma Stone, our boy Mark Ruffalo, Willem Dafoe, Rami Youssef. I'm not that knowledgeable about Yorgos Lanthimos. I really enjoyed The Favorite and I liked The Lobster, and I didn't see Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is maybe bummer of the group. I think you warned me about that.
Definitely puts you in a weird mental place, which given your current situation, I would not recommend.
Thankfully, Poor Things is not that kind of movie. It's whimsical, but it's like a dark, twisted Wes Anderson movie. It's kind of like if Wes Anderson and Tim Burton had sex and murdered each other, and then out came Yorgos Lanthimos and made a movie. It's a really visually beautiful movie. It's droll and funny, but in a fucked kind of way. Like, it's best not to know too much about what it is. I didn't know what the premise really was, but it's better to find out for yourself and just gasp and groan and laugh as the movie reveals its premise. Some really great performances and like a really nice traditional story being told in the midst of all its weirdness. I really recommend this movie.
Everything I've heard about Poor Things and its story has been disjointed and out of context.
Okay.
I am always like, what? That can't be what it's about. But then people are like, oh, yeah, it's pretty good. And I'm like, but if it's about what I heard it was about, it can't be. No.
It's not that hard to explain, but I'd rather not give my pitch of what it is.
Yeah, no, I do plan to watch it really soon, maybe even tonight after hearing you heap praise on it. You watched Zone of Interest too.
Yeah, I've been trying to cram them in for the Oscar. Not that I don't really care that much, but somehow it still feels like
a
thing.
A fuck.
Like, you're like, oh, you're a movie guy? Well, have you seen all the nominees? No, I haven't, but I've seen a few of them.
I've barely seen any of them. I don't even know what's nominated, honestly. I haven't been following the Oscars very closely this year.
Okay. Yeah.
Feels like 2023 was a down year for movies in general.
I'm more interested in some of the more fringe contenders. As you know, I was a Maestro fan, which is now like pretty much out of the running.
Bradley Cooper's been doing some wild interviews. Have you seen any of this?
He's a freak ball. Yeah. He keeps saying weird shit. Nobody knows why.
It's like, yeah, I shower with my son. I used to shower with my dad all the time. I'm like, what? How does this help people go see your movie?
He's a weirdo.
He does one interview a year and he gets real fucked up for it.
Like, yeah. That's kind of what I liked about that movie though, is like, it's the twisted version of the Hollywood biopic. Whereas like, then I recently finally watched Oppenheimer and I'm like, it's heavily dramatized, but it's still like a walk hard parody biopic. I don't know. I'm not sure I really liked it.
Give him a minute, son. Oppenheimer needs to think about his entire life before he become death.
That's kind of what happens in the movie. Not to spoil it for anybody.
I had this similar experience with Oppenheimer as you did. I actually haven't finished it yet. I'm watching it in 20-minute bite-sized pieces, yeah, which is as Christopher Nolan intended, I'm sure. But I couldn't get into it right away. So I decided to watch something a little more stripped down, a little less bombastic, perhaps, than Poor Things.
But
it focuses on God's chosen favorites, podcasters.
Neat.
It was called Monolith, which I think I told you not much about, but just that it was good.
Tell me about it now.
I would say it's roughly a horror movie and a bit of a mystery, but it's also like a bottle movie, the same way that some TV shows have bottle episodes. It takes place in one location for the vast majority of it, and it's about a disgraced journalist who basically had to recant an article that she wrote that she still feels was true, attacking like another public figure who was going to sue, and she's now slumming it as a podcaster. She doesn't seem too thrilled with the idea and doing like a mystery podcast, but she gets a mysterious email that says the truth will out about this person and the bricks. So she starts investigating these bricks. They're kind of a global phenomenon. People get them and they bring about these very dark and intrusive thoughts.
Ooh.
But then almost like the ring from Lord of the Rings, like you still want it around though, like you're weirdly attached to it, but it makes you miserable. And she starts digging deeper into it, and then she thinks it's all just a farce until the happenings happen, and she starts maybe believing in it. But I did a tweet from the Blast Zone Twitter account a couple weeks ago about horror movies. I said that some of them are Babadooks and some of them are just monsters. Whatever the thing tormenting our protagonist is, if it's a Babadook movie, then, you know, it's a metaphor for grief or trauma or some kind of repressed thing. So I would say Monolith, they're definitely going for a Babadook type vibe, but it was really well acted. There's basically one person that you see in the entire movie. Lily Sullivan is an Australian actor. She gives a really good performance, and you have to in a movie where you're the only face anyone's going to see on screen.
Yeah.
But I really liked it. I guess it came out in 2022, but it wasn't widely available, and now it's streaming and you can see it relatively easily. So I definitely recommend it. And it's about podcasting. We love a movie about a podcast.
I don't want to have podcast nightmares, though. That would be scared to watch it.
When I said it's a horror movie, like there's no gore at all in it. Okay. There's no jump scares. It's more of a creepy mystery than a horror movie, I guess I would say. But you might be uneasy, but I don't think you'll ever be frightened, truly.
I like the way podcasting is for me now. It's my little safe space.
How am I going to convince you to watch this movie?
Is it short? That might convince me.
It is short. Yeah, I think it's 92 minutes. Speaking of movies, that's not my best segue, but Virtuosity. Ian, did you even know this movie existed before I put it on the list?
I like heard the name, so that's probably as far as I can go. I've heard other people reference it as an example of how weird that movies treated high-tech internet subjects in the 90s. So I maybe would have recognized it as an example of that, but I didn't know a dang thing about it.
So when you heard the title and the wacky premise, and then you turn it on and it's starring fucking Denzel Washington, were you a little surprised? Because like in 1995, I was like 8 years old. I was like, cool, robots. And I love this movie. But now as an adult, I'm like, what the fuck was Denzel doing in 1995 that he made this movie? Like he'd already been Malcolm X.
There's a major cognitive dissonance in that. Denzel's too good for this movie. Everything he does in this movie feels like he's struggling really hard to bring it back down to earth. And the movie is so flighty and light and dumb, sorry to say.
You can cut this movie like down the middle and be like, all right, Denzel, Russell Crowe, and William Forsythe are kind of like killing it. And then everybody else just sucks. Like,
yeah.
The acting across the board from everybody else is universally terrible. Even little Kaylee Cuoco, sorry to say.
But yeah, she's all right. If anyone is in the middle, it's maybe her because she just has kid kind of things to say.
Do you think it's important for a first baseman to be left-handed? That was such shorthand for this little girl's difference.
Right.
She's tomboyish and worldly. She knows about baseball.
I was thinking about shorthand a lot in this movie. At least there, they're like, how do we connect this man and this kid? And they're like, let's give her a cute line that makes her say something unexpected that would engage the guy. And it was way too shorthanded, but I was like, okay, at least they got through that part. Now they're bonded and I don't have to watch more of them struggling to bond. But yeah, a lot of the writing in this movie, it has a bunch of sci-fi premise stuff in it that's conceptually cool. Like, oh, I would put that in a sci-fi movie and it sounds like it would be good. And then when they get to the part where people have to talk and convey ideas and even just connect with each other, the writing gets really bad. And you're like, that didn't work. They didn't say the things that you needed them to say in that scene. There's a big big disconnect between the ideas and the execution.
Yeah, I remember even being so young by the time I couldn't see this movie in theaters, obviously, because it was rated R for good reason. Pretty fucked up. But when it came to HBO, we had the illegal box or whatever, I remember being really excited. Then I watched it and I think I like convinced myself I really liked it because it seemed like a movie I should really like as a 9 year old. But it's not a movie I remember watching like over and over again, like some of the other ones we talk about. I know I was super excited when it was on HBO and I wanted it to be one of those movies, and it just never was. Like it faded from my memory until I started going back through. And actually, funny story about this movie and why it's on the schedule is I only rediscovered it when we recorded our lost episode, Fallen.
Oh.
So this is the first Denzel episode we're releasing, but not the first Denzel episode we've made. I'm giving the fans a little behind the scenes Easter egg here.
I forgot that Fallen died on the vine. I thought we talked
about
Fallen.
Yeah, it's in the bag. We never put Fallen out. It wasn't edited.
It's in my canon as an episode, in my head canon, but it's not in the real world.
We recorded the movie Fallen to be the first episode of 2023's Blasttober, and then we ended up having to go on indefinite hiatus.
Right.
And we were like, what do we do with Fallen? And we still haven't really decided.
I forgot that was the one that got orphaned.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was ready to drop all kinds of Fallen references, and our audience will not get them all unless they've been secretly keeping up with us on the side.
I don't think we ever even announced that Fallen was going to be a movie. I think we were doing Blasttober as like secretive this year. So maybe we'll re-record it next year because, spoiler alert, we both pretty much liked it.
Yeah. And there are some parallels.
There are.
Which I might still bring up and try to explain laboriously.
Yeah, why not? That sounds fun. You like when we describe a movie you've never seen? What if we describe two movies you've never seen and then compare them?
And go, isn't it interesting how similar they are? That we'd have no way to judge.
You want me to tell the story of how Virtuosity got made?
Why not? Let's hear how this thing happened.
I wrote this monologue on a bunch of Adderall, so we'll see how it goes.
Cool.
Brett Leonard really wanted to warn us about virtual reality. The director, who had previously moonlighted as Jumbo, one of the titular clowns from Killer Clowns from Outer Space, hit it big when he directed 1992's Stephen King adaptation The Lawnmower Man. You couldn't see me, but I was doing air quotes around the word adaptation. Because, you see, King's story focuses on the title character who strips naked and eats newly cut grass while controlling his lawnmower with his mystic powers. Leonard's movie wisely eschewed some of the more outrageous aspects of King's story and focused on the dangers of psychoactive drugs and virtual reality.
Metaverse, not even once.
Made for a modest $10 million and featuring visual effects that were considered cutting edge at the time, but have aged quite terribly, The Lawnmower Man would make $150 million worldwide, but was met with poor reviews and backlash from King himself, who sued the filmmakers to get his name removed from the film. Fun side note, he won, but New Line Cinemas just kind of forgot and were held in contempt of court for leaving his name on it.
Did I do that?
As an almost too perfect sign of his fortunes changing, Leonard would next direct a movie based on a novel by the other super prolific, if less widely respected horror novelist, Dean Koontz. Hideaway, released in March of 1995 and starring Jeff Goldblum and Alicia Silverstone, got even worse reviews than Lawnmower Man and made far less, earning $26 million on a $15 million budget. It's also extremely terrible. But Leonard wasn't done for the year. He had an ambitious project that would bring him back to the world of virtual reality, bafflingly named Virtuosity. Written by Eric Berndt, the extremely convoluted story focuses on a former cop named Parker Barnes, played by Denzel Washington, who is serving a long prison sentence for the intentional murder of political terrorist Matthew Grimes, who had killed Parker's wife and daughter, and also the accidental murder of two news reporters who thought it was a good idea to sneak up on him and surprise him right after he shot Grimes.
Journalists with ideas that good, they could be editing the New York Times.
Barnes is being used as a guinea pig for a new virtual reality training program the LAPD is considering implementing, featuring an antagonist that is an amalgamation of literally hundreds of history's most deadly killers, named SID 6.7. SID stands for Sadistic, Intelligent, and Dangerous, by the way, because it's 1995. Some of the killers featured in Sid's profile are Ted Bundy, Billy the Kid, and Adolf Hitler. Sid goes rogue and makes it into the real world because of reasons, and a cat and mouse game ensues. It sounds like a movie with all the makings of a complete schlockfest, except the filmmakers had an ace up their sleeve. A relatively unknown Australian actor named Russell Crowe was cast as Sid 6.7.
Are you not entertained?
The rest of the cast was rounded out with reliable actors like Kelly Lynch, William Fichtner, William Forsythe, and William Forsythe's mustache. Given a budget of $30 million, filming began in January of 1995, with Washington restructuring much of the story and dialogue during the filming process. Released on August 4th, 1995, to overwhelmingly negative reviews and indifferent audiences, the movie would make $37 million worldwide, clearly losing money. It exists now as less of a movie than a fascinating time capsule of 1995.
so long ago, this director trying to do virtual reality stuff in 92, my calculator's right, that's at least 30 years ago. Like, how far has virtual reality come from the ideas that they had about it back then?
Not even like halfway?
Like, not far enough. Like, it's kind of the same stuff they're wrestling with theirs. It's the same issues. It looks fake.
Makes you nauseous.
Yeah. The interfaces are terrible. I mean, talk about clunky goggles. The VR interfaces in this thing pick you up and jiggle you around and make you all kinds of crazy.
Can you imagine if that's like what VR was? You were like, all right, I'm going to go play Blast Saber or whatever it's called.
Right.
And I got to go strap myself into like the Vitruvian Man.
There's some silly sci-fi in it. And those are some of the silliest parts. So to get into the VR headset, it's not just a headset. It like straps to your chest and lifts you off the ground. And then they've got these scenes where Denzel and
Donovan,
his other inmate that got roped into this thing, they're like being dangled and thrown around. They're all going, la, 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 and like, it's pretty funny. It's pretty silly on a visual level.
Here's a little Ian and John tidbit. Back in the day when we both first got our Oculus Quests, we used to play ping pong sometimes.
That was fun.
Just hang out and chat while we played ping pong.
We never got a brain stimulation overload that sent us into shock and killed us, thankfully.
I died briefly.
Oh, okay. But, sorry about that.
Yeah, it was fun. But also, VR is still pretty shitty today. It's much better than it was. But like, this movie was written and made in 1995, and it takes place in 1999. It's like, that what you thought computers were going to be like in 1999?
It's not like super far in the future where there's flying cars. There's just little things here and there, but it's a weird future. There's weird ideas in this.
Yeah, even like the VR environment that we open in is vaguely like Matrix-y, but like much less believable. All the dudes like look the same and walk the same, but then we get these super racist like Asian caricatures when they go to the sushi restaurant.
I'm
like,
that was weird.
Yeah, 99, we were still doing that, huh? Like they're geishas. I was like, why are the geishas the waitresses at the sushi restaurant?
Why aren't they just waitresses? Why are they geishas? That's an excellent question that I barely had time to think about. I did give the movie some credit right away. It opens up and I was like, oh boy, we're doing a science fiction. And then I'm like, oh, we're doing a Matrix? I had to give it some credit. It predates the Matrix by 4 years. And that first scene, even though I didn't like it that much, I'm like,
it sucks.
It's got some Matrix-y flavor that like is not all that different. It's got all these weird sort of glitchiness. I mean, in the Matrix, it's a much bigger concept because that's supposed to be what everyone believes is the real world. The players know that they're in a virtual reality game in this, but it's got those funny like NPCs walking around and repeating their little catchphrases. It's got some all right stuff, except it looks goofy as hell. Maybe we'll get into it when we go through it plot point by plot point, but
yeah, there's a lot wrong with it.
I couldn't figure out whether I respected it or hated it at this point.
I thought when I was researching this movie, I would stumble onto some indication that Brett Leonard was more of a computer programmer who like just got into movie making the same way like Michael Crichton was a doctor that got into like writing and movie making. All the medical stuff in Crichton's books were always very well done and well researched, but then everything else was a mess. Like I get that vibe with Brett Leonard and computers, but now he's making like Christian dramas with Terrence Howard.
Okay.
So I don't know what the fuck to think. I guess you got to pay the bills.
They throw a lot of lingo at you, which every old-timey sci-fi movie does, but they use terms like neural net. I don't really know what that means today, but I'm like,
some kind of genetic algorithms.
Okay, that part, there's definitely a section where they get way out over their skis on the computer technology stuff.
Sid mentions that he's like, I'm a 50 terabyte backflip off the high dive.
Right.
And I was like, that's like how many movies I have on my Plex, like 50 terabytes? Like, you can't make a person out of that.
Now we know that because you've tried to make one out of movies and it doesn't do anything but play movies back at
which
you.
Is cool.
And that does seem, that seems like a lot of data back then. I think I would have been impressed with hearing that number in a movie in the 90s.
I wouldn't have even known what it meant, to be honest.
They spent some time on the premise and on the hard sci-fi pieces of it, but it's not that fun. We're going to talk about what Denzel does in this movie, what Russell Crowe does in this movie. They're both really good actors and they're both trying to make the movie into something watchable, but it ends up barely ever being fun. And like you said, how you thought you liked it. Those little parts that could be satisfying despite a movie breaking down on a bigger plot or conceptual level, it lacks those. Even those moments are not very fun on their own. They're all stunted and weak.
Yeah, it's strange for a movie this silly. You'd expect it to be more fun, but it never connects those dots.
Yeah, Russell Crowe is trying really hard to be like a fun maniac, and I like him, but I don't really.
Yeah, I think he pulls it off, but there's only so much one performance or two performances can do to elevate a movie of this level. I guess we should start talking about the story, right? So we can get into these details.
Sure. LAPD detective Parker Barnes, played by Denzel Washington, used to be a good cop. Probably the best cop ever. Until one day, a serial terrorist bomber named Grimes kills Barnes' wife and daughter. In retaliation, Barnes kills Grimes and some bystanders too. But you're not supposed to do that, so Barnes is sentenced to jail for murder. Now, as a prison inmate, Barnes has been made into a human guinea pig. He's forced to test out a virtual reality simulation, which a company called LeeTech is developing to train law enforcement. But one of the company's programmers is actually an evil mastermind named Daryl. Daryl created a virtual persona named Sid 6.7, played by Russell Crowe, that incorporates the minds of 100 real-life serial killers. Sid is a sadistic, intelligent, and dangerous opponent inside the virtual reality game, and Barnes is the only player even close to matching up with him. But then, Daryl helps Sid escape the computer and take on a real-world body made out of nanobots. Suddenly, the super killer is on the loose on the streets of LA, so Barnes is given a new offer he can't refuse. He'll be granted a full pardon if he can track down and arrest Sid 6.7 in real life. Now it's personal.
Man, there is just a lot of plot there, and a lot of it feels unnecessary. Doesn't this whole setup seem needlessly complicated? Of like, Barnes was a cop, but then he did a bad thing. Now he's not a cop anymore, but he's still friends with the cops. He's being used as a guinea pig in this new training simulation. You know, like, couldn't you have cut most of that shit out and just like, he's a cop. This other guy killed his family years ago, and now he's put back in this body.
Yeah, it's like either motivate him with, oh, you're tracking down the guy who killed your family, or you're a cop who's falsely imprisoned and this is your only chance of freedom. But they stacked both, and then they do it with a slow reveal over the course of the movie. You don't really understand all those details until late in the movie. They do the full flashback and show you exactly what happened. It's overstuffed, and I don't know if I could say, like, I don't know if that's why the movie suffers, but it's one of the reasons probably.
It does. It needs a lot of setup to get to the good stuff, at least, which is unfortunate. But I found Sid way more interesting in the computer when he's able to manipulate the environment around him. I feel like we get more of a glimpse of his personality. And I do take issue with you calling Daryl an evil mastermind, because I think Daryl's just kind of a pushover. I don't think he ever intended for any of this to happen. But once Sid intimidates him into doing it, he's like, well, I guess I got to see it through.
Well, that's an interesting take. Daryl is definitely one of the parts of the movie that confounded me. He's just kind of there. So I guess he's free for you to project whatever you want on him, because he's the architect of the most evil murderer that the world has ever known. But it's like, why is that necessary for training cops? Is like police work all about serial killers and not just regular ones, but like
right. Super
Hitler level Manson infused serial killers?
Yeah, who is this for? The training exercise we see is just Denzel trying to shoot this guy. Why does he have to be Hitler and Mengele
yeah. And
like Stalin and Mussolini and John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy for all of this? Why can't he just be like a guy?
Right. And how is that like police work? It's just shooting work. Like, it's more of a video game than it is an actual police training, because how many officers do you need that are trained to like take down super villains?
I could see VR being an effective tool for training like SWAT teams, but Barnes was a detective and that's who they seem to be like tailoring this towards.
Yeah. Or if it's for cops in general, like diffusing domestic violence situations,
right?
Not like how to best shoot up a sushi restaurant and only hit the masterminds.
That would be an effective training thing. Like, we put a mentally ill man inside this simulation and you have to defuse the situation without shooting him. Like, let's train our cops on that. Or hey, like maybe respond to this domestic dispute without killing a dog. Something like that
right. Would
probably be helpful.
That would be helpful. This movie is not interested in that level of nuance. It is going balls to the wall from the moment you see Sid. He's a maniac and he has a strong characterization, but it's very hard to make sense of it.
Yeah. He loves music and classical music specifically. He's also dressed like one of the weasels from Who Framed Roger Rabbit for some reason. He's wearing a bright green suit. He's got a pompadour. I mean, young Russell Crowe was a handsome guy, but why is he this way? Like, you put all these John Wayne Gacy, Billy the Kid, like famously ugly people. And it's okay to say that about them because they were murderers.
Uh-huh, sure.
It's okay to show them nude because they ain't got no souls. And then you come out with this guy. I don't know. I don't understand where all these pieces come together. He doesn't really seem like any of these personalities.
No, they don't bother explaining. Like, his dominant personality is something that's based on a movie studio's idea. Like, remember Silence of the Lambs and how Hannibal Lecter was sophisticated and also incredibly sick and twisted? Let's do that. And they're like, but yeah, but we also made this character and he has a history with this other guy who was not like that. Okay, we'll make him like that guy too. And then it's like, there's too much in the stew that is Sid. And they call that out. They go, yes, Sid's literally made out of 200 serial killer brains that were all incubated together. And his personalities are fighting for who's dominant, but they're not.
No.
He's very much like a purple suit music guy.
Yeah, he's got a distinct personality of his own.
Yeah, when you first meet him, he goes to incredible incredible lengths to make music metaphors in every line he says. And you're like, this is the music guy. Where does the music come from? There's never any hint of that.
Yeah, who's like the musician serial killer?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
But the movie's leaving us with questions.
But he gets brought into the real world in one of my favorite lines ever delivered. So let's set it up. There's this little sex pot VR creation named Sheila 3.2 or who cares.
Something like that. Yep.
And she's super horny. That's basically all her personality is. Even though Daryl plays chess with her, she even makes that horny. Like she's jerking off the pieces or whatever. I don't know. But sorry, I made Ian choke. What would you call him? He's not just like a goon because he's clearly like a pretty advanced scientist in his own right, Clyde.
Yeah, you can tell who the brainiac scientists are in this movie because one of them's named Daryl and the other one's name is Clyde.
Daryl and Clyde.
Clyde is not as elevated within the company because Daryl wears a very sharp three-piece suit. Maybe that's where some of Sid's style comes from. He's got the same shoulder pads that Sid prefers.
Very 90s.
Clyde wears a rumpled coat and he works in the basement, but he works on something to me even more impressive, nanobots.
Yeah.
Making nanobots that sort of spontaneously come to life.
He makes a snake out of inorganic matter and then he very inelegantly holds it up to Daryl's face and goes like,
check out the snake, bro.
He's that kind of guy. But Clyde's super horny for Sheila and Sid's like, that's our way in. He wants to basically tell Clyde we can make Sheila into a real body that you can have sex with, probably. That's probably what he's going to do, at the very least. But we'll switch out the modules, so he's actually making Sid into a real body, and this all goes down, and Sid is kind of born out of this pod.
An alien pod that forms out of nanobots.
And by the time he, like, turns around, he's Russell Crowe, fully nude. Russell Crowe, standing, I don't know, 4 feet away from Clyde, and Clyde just goes, Sheila?
It's highly improbable that he has been duped at this point. Although it's kind of like, what do you say? I don't know. This is all new ground for everyone right. involved. No one's ever turned a computer module into a living, breathing human body before. It might be just his last gasp. He's holding on to his dream, which was meeting Sheila.
But hold on to something. You know what I mean?
Sheila didn't have those bulging lats or even the glutes that Russell Crowe shows in the scene.
Yeah, he was quite a specimen.
Ooh, yeah.
So then he crushes Clyde's windpipe and the story can advance. But yeah. Fucking fantastic line reading by whoever played Clyde. I'm not going to look him up because fuck him.
But he was pretty good. It's a good crop of character actors throughout this movie. They fill their very 90s roles admirably.
Except for Louise Fletcher.
Oh, yeah.
I know you. She's pretty terrible. Like, I didn't single her out as being bad till I read your note. And then when I was doing my rewatch, I paid extra attention to her lines. And yeah, it's like almost like she's reading them phonetically.
She's really weird.
Like, she doesn't speak English, but like they just sound these words out.
Forgive me. Like, I know that Louise Fletcher has a stellar reputation. If only based on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where she played Nurse Ratched, which is like an iconic role. And so I'm like, oh, she must be an iconic actor. And she's in this movie, like she didn't understand any words she said. She smiles through them. Like she has this tough negotiation against Denzel where she's offering him his pardon.
Which, by the way, why can the city police pardon a multiple murderer? That's a federal crime. You probably need a lot more people involved to make that happen.
You probably do. But this movie takes the attitude like, hey, it's the future. Nothing matters. Just talk your way out of anything that you need to happen for plot reasons. But yeah, Commissioner Dean, she smiles through this tough negotiation with Denzel, who's playing it very serious and grounded. He's like, why should I care? You want me to do your dirty work? And she's just grinning like she doesn't know what she's saying. She's like,
that's the deal.
That's the deal. And then she wins the argument. Like the next scene, it cuts to him getting suited up.
He's like, damn it. I couldn't win the argument. I guess I could see that being frustrating. It's like arguing with a brick wall.
That's true. It may have accidentally hit on an interesting real world foil for this Denzel character. Right. But
just like bureaucrats rising to the level of their own incompetence and then like negotiating by just being like, well, I guess.
Strange stuff.
Is there anything else in this section we had to talk about? This movie's so fucking weird, man. This movie's insane.
Yeah, it doesn't. The insanity doesn't let up. So I guess we might as well keep moving.
Oh, yeah. I think the second act is probably the craziest because we get the whole nightclub symphony.
There's a lot to come. Let's hear what happens next.
Not for Clyde, though. Get it? Wordplay.
Oh.
Like ejaculating. Barnes sets out to track down Sid, and he's accompanied by criminal psychologist Dr. Madison Carter, played by Kelly Lynch. Dr. Carter informs Barnes that one of the personalities that went into Sid's aggregated brain is none other than Barnes's old nemesis Grimes. So now it's personal. Meanwhile, Sid has begun his real-world crime spree. He takes over a futuristic disco, and using the DJ equipment, Sid orchestrates his hostages' screams of fear into a symphony of terror. Barnes shows up and shoots Sid, but Sid is able to get away and repair his silicone body. Barnes figures out Sid craves public attention and TV cameras, so he tracks Sid to a live pay-per-view event of the Ultimate Fighting Championship at a local arena. Barnes chases Sid out of the arena and onto a nearby light rail platform. Sid grabs a woman as a human shield, and in a standoff with Barnes, the woman ends up shot dead and Sid escapes. Some of the bystanders blame Barnes for shooting the woman, and the cops on scene arrest Barnes and take him away in a paddy wagon. Then Sid hijacks the police van, freeing Barnes, but making it look like Barnes murdered his captors. The company is ready to give up on Barnes, so they prepare to trigger a microchip in Barnes' neck, terminating him for failing his mission and going rogue. But Police Chief Billy Cochran, played by William Forsythe, believes his old buddy Barnes is not to blame and intervenes to stop the remote execution. Barnes is left alive, but he's all alone, knowing he must find and face down Sid in order to save his reputation. Now it's personal again.
It gets real personal over and over.
Keeps getting personaler.
They stack them up.
Virtuosity 2. This time it's even more personaler.
The personalists.
This is something we talked about off mic, and I think now is a good time to bring it up, because as silly as the movie is in Act 1, it gets even sillier in Act 2. I don't even think it's really a discussion. I think this is hands down Denzel Washington's silliest movie.
I was trying to think about that. I'm not a Denzel expert, but hopefully this is as far as he ever had to lower himself in his fine career.
He's never been in a comedy, as far as I could tell, unless you count like Roman J. Esquire. I know there was comedic elements to that movie, but he's just a very serious guy. I can't think of another movie he ever made that even walks up to this level of chicanery.
And let's be clear, this movie's not trying to be a comedy. It has these outrageous elements because the villain is such a strange freakball, and he thinks he's funny while he's doing sadistic, awful things, that it has this high-spirited feel to the crimes going on. But Denzel's character, Barnes, is the most saddest fucked up guy you can imagine, right? He triggered the death of his wife and child and lost his arm in the process, and then he killed the killer, but he killed some innocent bystanders, and now he's in prison. Everything about him is truly fucked up and sad.
I don't think he smiles until little Kaley Cuoco asks him about the first baseman.
No, I think you're right.
And that might be the only time he smiles in the whole
movie.
Yeah,
he's pretty dark, and he's trying so hard to make all his moments as a character grounded and real, and like they mostly work because it's Denzel, and he's one of the best ever at doing that. But the movie is so silly and so thin. You mentioned in your monologue that he rewrote a lot of this stuff, and God, you hate to see what it was on the page before he got to it.
How bad it must have been. Yeah. Originally, they were eyeing Michael Douglas for this role, which they definitely chose better. But what if Denzel wasn't on set steering them? Like, originally, there was going to be a love story between Kelly Lynch's character, Dr. Carter, and Barnes, but Denzel just nixed that. Even though they do have a couple weird moments that might have been left over, like when he touches her hand during the interview.
Yeah, there's some false starts at creating some sexual tension between the two, but I was glad that wasn't there. And that's where I was going to bring up the comparison to Fallen, because Fallen also has attractive male and female leads that end up needing each other and helping each other, but they don't do the typical let's get together thing, which I found refreshing in both cases.
That's true. And he's also a cop that's being framed for murder in Fallen.
That's right.
Although he wasn't framed for murder in this movie, he definitely killed those people.
Well, he killed the original people, but in the middle of the movie, Sid does frame him for a couple other
murders. Yeah, he does frame him for murders. Because Sid be killing. I at least give the movie credit for that. There's not like a whole like fish out of water segment where he's just like trying to understand the world. He's like, nope, I'm going to immediately start murdering people.
Yeah, he does kill a lot of people. I agree with you on that. The tone of some of those scenes look so light that you're like, oh, they're going to like Hollywood out and go, well, he doesn't really kill anybody, but he scares some people. And so he's really a bad guy. Right. But no, he does just break some people's necks, throw them off of things, shoot them.
He cuts off two people's heads. Wealthy couple. And then writes death to the pigs on the wall. And then they're like, he's copying Manson. It's like, that's like the lamest shit. I don't know. Charles Manson was a fucking idiot. Like, I feel like we're not giving Sid enough credit by having him like ape Manson's bullshit.
Obligatory. And didn't add to the story.
Doesn't go anywhere. Like with the rest of his murders, though, like it doesn't, that thread is never picked up again, that he's like doing signatures of famous killers. That's the only time he ever really does that.
Except for Grimes. Then he becomes obsessed with Grimes, who is a fictional character created for the movie as Barnes's old nemesis. And then he's purple suit music guy. And then the only thing that he is other than that is fucking Grimes. He's hardcore Grimes. And he just keeps saying Grimes' catchphrases. And Barnes has to keep calling out, he's saying my catchphrase. That happens like 6 times in the movie.
Which isn't it just like, this one's for you, Barnes. Like, that's not a catchphrase.
It's not a good catchphrase. No, it's hardly anything.
It's like being like, oh, he's saying this catchphrase. And he's like, how are you doing? I guess that was a catchphrase on the show Friends. So bad
there
example.
You go.
But how funny would it, like the fact that they invented a arch nemesis for Barnes gave me a whole other path we could have gone down with this movie, where Barnes's nemesis was a real killer, but like one of the crazy ones I put in there, like Idi Amin. What if Barnes's nemesis was like Benito Mussolini?
And now he's marching around downtown LA.
He's like, these fucking trains, man. They're late. Because the trains ran on time under Mussolini.
That's joke. What they say.
But then Sid also steals suits from that elderly couple, but I guess they weren't ostentatious enough for him because he has to go get something more purple.
From one of the very fake patrons of this very fake looking futuristic nightclub.
My problem with nightclubs in movies is that they're never full enough. If you've ever been to a nightclub, it's fucking miserable, asses to elbows. The only movie I give credit to for making it look real is Collateral.
Yeah, Collateral does it pretty good.
When like Ruffalo's trying to get to the target before Tom Cruise can, he's just like stuck behind 1,000 people. And I'm like, that's what it's like trying to order a drink at any club I've ever been to.
Yeah.
But in this one, there's 8 feet between every patron.
There's hardly anybody in this club because they need to be able to see them full body because they're all wearing futury outfits and enjoying some futury music.
There's like kind of a steampunky vibe to it. I definitely saw some goggles.
Yeah.
But then there's also like a zoot suit element to it because the guy, he's like, took my suit. I spent $150 on it.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not a lot of money, even in 1995 for a suit.
I was wondering, was that supposed to be ironic? Was that supposed to be serious?
He said it was custom too. A custom suit for $150 is, I guess you can get custom suits for $600-$700 now, which is probably equivalent.
Yeah. Ironically, a bunch of the movie is set in the garment district in downtown LA where you probably could go get a custom suit for $150.
I do love how everything is so nearby in this movie. Like,
yeah.
He's at the UFC. Where's the arena? He's like, it's 3 blocks that way.
Yeah.
LA's huge.
Maybe Sid doesn't know how to get around. Although he does run for the Metro at one point. He could have been in Long Beach in 45 minutes.
He drives too. Remember, he's smashing the windshield and eating handfuls of glass to repair himself.
Of a police car he hijacked. We should talk about that. Sid has kind of Terminator 2 powers in this.
A little bit.
I had to look it up. We talked about his Hannibal Lectory. That came out in 91. So they had just enough time to be inspired by that, as well as 1991's T2.
It's crazy that T2 came out in 91. And also that Jurassic Park came out in 93. And then we got this shit.
We shouldn't mention, because if you mention any of that, this movie looks a million times worse because it is way behind the curve. Those movies were ahead of their time.
But actually, the raptors from Jurassic Park were also programmed into Sid's algorithm.
Yeah. Too bad Denzel didn't try some gymnastics on him.
Oh, that was the Lost World. That was 97.
But yeah, some really weak echoes of the Terminator when he gets damaged and he has to heal himself. And he does it in one case by eating glass. The rest of the time, he sucks it up through his finger.
When I turned this movie on, I was like, I'm probably going to see some wild shit. But Russell Crowe smashing windows and eating glass to regenerate his bullet holes was not on the list of things I expected to see.
He got real snacky there in the police car and he started grabbing handfuls off the dashboard and munching them down.
It's like one of those My Strange Addiction shows. Lois eats glass. Her family has pled with her to stop. But she says it heals her bullet wounds.
It works good. Sid heals repeatedly. I mean, it's kind of the story of the middle of this movie. He gets shot. He gets shot some more, but he just keeps healing it back up.
He goes to another like very public place and does some strange crime.
Are you talking about the UFC?
Yeah. This made me embarrassed to enjoy the UFC.
But you've been a UFC fan for a while. You knew it was super weird when it started. And this is in the bridge years between when it was really rough and when it was turning into something real. I was surprised. I had to double check to make sure that it really said Ultimate Fighting Championship and it used their actual logo.
It did.
But yeah, they borrowed the real thing. They also borrowed Ken Shamrock. That was the only fighter that I recognized who was in that cage.
They didn't have my man Art Jimmer with the one boxing glove.
Oh, no. I didn't spot him.
If only. No, he was like a UFC 1 or 2 guy. He was when they still had no rounds, no weight classes. Aren't. Yeah, this is like pre-Dana White and the Fertittas taking over.
And in this fight, which is otherwise using the official logo, and it's got like an octagon, but like they're doing a Royal Rumble, right? There's at least 3 fights going on.
So yeah, there's like 5 guys in there.
That's not very realistic.
And no referee as far as I could tell.
No, it's just, which Buffer brother is it? It's not.
It's Bruce. It's the UFC Buffer.
Oh,
Michael
okay.
Buffer is the famous one.
Okay, this is Michael then, though, right? This is
the Let's Get Ready to Rumble guy? Oh, is it? I didn't notice.
This is the real Michael Buffer.
Isn't it so funny that like they're brothers and they both do that for a living?
When you got that voice, I guess you gotta milk it.
I don't think they talk either. I think they're estranged.
Oh, interesting.
Bruce Buffer's a weird guy, man. There should be a documentary about Bruce Buffer.
There should. Yeah, I would watch a Buffer Brothers documentary. That would be cool.
Not to be confused with the Duffer Brothers, who are a filmmaking pair who made Stranger Things.
Yeah, we should tip the Ben Affleck to that story. I'd like to see Ben Affleck make that. I think he could play one of them very convincingly.
He could definitely play Bruce. He's got like that kind of more rectangular face like Bruce has, whereas Michael's more of a Matt Damon.
Curly hair.
That could be the movie. They finally reunite and make the Buffer movie together.
Yeah. Why are they wasting time making Air when they could make the Buffer Brothers story?
Air was so boring. It was like, why are we fucking patting corporations on the back in every movie now?
It was light fare, but I actually enjoyed it. I don't know if this is the time to to litigate air, but I kind of enjoyed
it. I mean, I thought I would like a less officially licensed storytelling of Nike's early days.
Yeah.
Enough with these fucking corporate sanctioned biopics. But anyway, we're getting away from ourselves. So he does some wild shit at the UFC, of course. A cop shoots his hand off. He licks a girl's face. It's all very strange.
Yeah.
He backflips off the... Like, he seems shocked when he lands and it hurts. Like, he fucks himself up, kind
of. Yeah, it's a bunch of stitched together antics. Maybe that's the problem I have with Sid, is like, it doesn't really cohere. It's like, oh, well, we need him to go to this thing. They keep hammering home that, like, he's searching for bigger and bigger audiences. He loves the camera on him. He loves crowds. That's what he's getting off on. And so the middle of the movie is him seeking out bigger and bigger opportunities for that. But then he gets there and he just does random antics. Like, he just gets there. And then as soon as Barnes shows up, he chases him out of the place. And they're like, let's do some antics on a light rail platform instead.
He is like a psychotic Bugs Bunny to some extent.
It's true.
Where William Fichtner's character, who was hilariously named William Wallace, by the way, is like, he's evolving. And then the commissioner, bless her heart, Louise Fletcher, goes, into what? And then flash cut to him walking in the mall to the Bee Gees with his purple fucking suit on.
Yeah.
It's like, but that's the same guy we met before. That's exactly true. What you would expect him to be doing.
It's a good filmmaking when you do a visual answer to a question like that, but it doesn't actually move forward. You're right.
He's still the same guy.
It's a very subtle evolution from green to purple suit.
Yeah. First he went to like gray sports coat and black pants, right. But that was just a little too muted for him. A little too corporate. Not quite Brian Seltzer Orchestra-ish enough. The fucking cherry poppin' daddies. Remember when there was like a whole Zoot Zoot thing in the 90s?
Oh, yeah. Like,
unfortunately.
Yeah. They made a movie about it called Swingers. Yeah. Launched a few guys' career, but fortunately they left the actual Swingers dudes in the past pretty quick.
For the best. They should make a Swingers sequel where like they're all the age they are. Like the same actors. What kind of life are those guys living now? I bet they've like definitely given up on the Zoot Zoot lifestyle.
Still trying the swing dance moves, the Lindy Hop.
This ain't the Outsiders, you fucking weirdo. Get out of here. And then my man Billy Cochran.
Yeah.
A lot of people with the first name of their real name in this movie. William Forsythe is Billy Cochran. William Fichtner is William Wallace. William Wallace.
Yeah, it could get confusing. And they're both like character actors that you're like, I know that guy, but you might not know their names until you Google them right now to try to catch up with what we're saying.
Should I tell my semi-embarrassing William Forsythe anecdote?
Please do.
So William Forsythe in this movie looks like William Forsythe in every movie of the 90s. Just like the most generic looking cop you could imagine. Slick back blonde hair, mustache, live for New Year's Eve. No. But if you've ever seen The Rock, he's also this exact same character in The Rock. Just kind of like a cop trying to do the best he can. But then I was watching Boardwalk Empire is what it was. And William Forsythe plays a Polish butcher who's like also like a crime lord in that show. And I was like, oh, it's funny. There's two guys with very similar names. Like I thought it was like a Dermot Mulroney and Dylan McDermott situation where like they're two guys who are like roughly the same age and maybe look alike and have similar names, but have never, you know, they're distinct people.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh no, like William Forsythe just got fat. And that's just him. Like
it was the same guy.
He's
okay.
Both roles. No offense to William Forsythe. He's great in Boardwalk Empire too. But yeah, I thought it was like two guys. I guess he's kind of two guys now because he's twice the size he used to be.
Billy. That happens. He's had a long career.
Yeah.
Look at how far apart those two productions are.
Almost 30 years. No, that's not true. It's about 20 years, I think.
Okay. We're getting on 30 years of this movie.
Yeah, but then Boardwalk Empire was like the 2010s.
Oh, okay.
By the time that came out. But yeah, he's still acting.
Everything after 2000 is last year to me, so.
That's fair. But Billy Cochran is just a fucking real stand-up dude, ride or die friend. He doesn't even try to argue his point about why they shouldn't kill Barnes. He just goes into the room, fucking shoots. Doesn't he shoot up the control board?
There's a moment of doubt where you're like, oh no, Barnes is getting railroaded. He didn't mean to shoot that lady, and maybe he didn't even shoot her at all. And even Cochran can't save him. They're going to terminate him. They're typing in the password. And then he like pops with the door. And I was sure like, oh, thank God.
He's going to talk him down.
He's going to tell him no. He's going to put his foot down. He doesn't say a damn thing. He busts into the room and just starts shooting at the console.
And then takes a chair and goes, anybody using this chair? And fucking slams it into all the equipment.
Smashes it in slow motion, disintegrates the giant screen that they were working on. It's very funny.
What if he accidentally shot the password in? Like he shot all the individual keys of the password.
I don't know how you did that.
I'm coming up with a lot of like scenarios for this movie that would have been even sillier, but way more entertaining.
Chief, I don't know what happened, but you shot the word password 123 right into the keyboard and Barnes is dead. I don't know how to tell you this.
That's the kind of password an idiot has in his luggage. That's a Spaceballs reference. Ian.
Okay.
I know you don't like that movie.
But I don't know it, but I like the reference.
So yeah, Billy, he's a true ride or die friend.
He's a good dude. You'd love to see him come through.
You almost think he might be crooked early on. Like maybe this guy's playing him or something, but no, he's just a legit good friend.
No, he's a real deal, which sets up the ending. Should we bring it home and see what happens to old Billy?
Let's do it. Probably people are more invested in the other characters, not Billy Cochran, but I'm all about Billy.
All right, bringing it home. Barnes and Dr. Carter immediately reunite in the search for Sid. Guess he wasn't alone for long. It doesn't take long to find Sid as he's hijacked a TV studio during a hugely popular televised political debate. As our heroes arrive at the Broadcast Center building, Sid reveals he has kidnapped Dr. Carter's young daughter and hidden her in a secret location with a bomb, just like Grimes did with Barnes's daughter years ago. So now it's personal for every person. Barnes chases Sid to the roof of the building for a dramatic rooftop fight sequence. It ends with Sid impaled on broken glass, but just as Barnes yanks the brain module from Sid's skull, he realizes he now has no way to find young Karen Carter before the bomb goes off. Then, we see the same rooftop fight sequence begin to replay from an earlier point in time. Turns out Barnes has reactivated Sid within the virtual world to trick Sid into thinking he's won this time and revealing Karen's location. Well, it works, but once Sid realizes it's a trick, he tries to trap Barnes inside the simulation and kill him with neural stimulation overload. Sid has help in the real world from evil Daryl, who kills Chief Billy. But Dr. Carter shoots Daryl and frees Barnes, and then they both rush to the rooftop silo where Karen is trapped. There, Barnes overcomes the last remnant of Sid's resistance by defusing Sid's bomb and booby traps to free Karen. Then Barnes destroys Sid's memory module for good by chucking it off the roof.
Probably should have stomped on it so you can make sure it's crushed.
Yeah, thankfully a SWAT van rolled up just at that moment and did the stomping for us, but it was an iffy way to get rid of this particularly pesky villain just by chucking him in the air. Where like, there's no way you could see where that thing landed. It's like a 50-story building he was on top of.
Right. You don't know how strong those modules are. Barnes being risky again. He's a rogue cop. He's taking the law into his own hands.
It's kind of the message of the movie. He never beats that rap.
No.
Except at the end, I guess he's really careful defusing young Kaylee Cuoco's bomb.
Can't believe they named her character Karen. It's so weird having a little girl named Karen. It's an old lady name, or at least like a middle-aged lady.
Yeah. Even in the 90s, is that what they were naming girls? Who knows?
I didn't know any girls named Karen, and I was a child in the 90s.
Okay.
A lot happens in this section, but I don't care about any of it. The movie kind of drags at the end, doesn't it? It gets bogged down, whereas you did a good job of pointing this out in your notes, but we have the chaos of the middle where Sid is just going to all these loud, crowded places and bringing chaos with him. And then he just like straps a bomb to a little girl inside of an empty silo. I don't know. It's not dynamic. It's not fun. It's exciting.
No, they tried to heighten that beat where his ultimate location is this nationally televised broadcast. But because it's a broadcast, it's no longer like an arena full of people. It's actually like a Twitter Spaces. It's like a virtual debate where all the sort of viewer stuff is like flashing on screen about the viewership and the comments and stuff. It's maybe it's prescient in that way.
It's like an early version of Pardon the Interruption on ESPN yeah. or something.
Yeah. But by its nature, it feels less big because it's just in a little cramped TV studio.
Yeah. And people say studio things like the ratings are through the roof.
Yeah. They've got all this real-time ratings stuff, which I guess is some of the futurism of it, which I guess comes true. Now we can see how many people are online for a live chat with the president or whatever. But
God, what would you even talk to him about? Butterscotch pudding?
That'd be a good choice. But like Barnes does away with that stuff really quick. He's like, you got to tell him to cut the phone lines. And then the famous criminal psychologist, Dr. Carter, I forgot her first name.
Not Linda.
It's Maddie. It's Madison Carter. It's not Linda Carter. Madison Carter runs around, as she does in the third act, flashing her badge, her criminal psychologist badge, which gets a lot of people doing things she says. Like, damn it, look at my psychologist badge, and cut the phone lines, and it works.
I have a lot of questions about her like role within the LAPD. She's like, I need to go on this manhunt for Sid with Barnes. Like, why? It's really poorly explained. Just so you could be like, death to the pigs, Charles Manson. Like, what cop doesn't know that?
I mean, she does one practical thing, which she's actually one of the most technically savvy people in the film. She's right up there with Daryl. She operates Daryl's computer when they break into his apartment.
All she has to do is say words. Open files.
Yeah, but Barnes can't handle that. He's like, I couldn't find a keyboard. Yeah, so they kind of get away from the meaningful stuff and get right to shoot 'em up action in this final sequence.
Yeah.
And they did another Matrix, I noticed. Did you pick up on the fact that they make Barnes run through the granite bank lobby of a skyscraper while a bunch of black clad people shoot machine guns at him and bust up the beautiful marble and granite columns?
I did not notice the similarity until I read your note.
Okay.
Yes, it is pretty jarring. But apparently they're just not concerned about Sid anymore. They're like, we're just got to kill Denzel Washington. That's the real problem.
They go whole hog. They unleash so much firepower.
Was that pun intended? The cops went whole hog.
I guess that's what they do. But yeah. they go off to a ridiculous amount. And I didn't get it because I'm like, his buddy, Chief Billy, is the literal police chief of LA. But then I noticed in second pass, they justify it. They're like, oh, there's a federal task force and the lady sicked the feds on him. And that's why so many of the cops are just all about unloading automatic weapons at Barnes while ignoring the fact that there's a literal self-professed serial killer on TV murdering people in real time. And they're like, no, ignore that guy. Let's get this ex-cop.
Even if Barnes was guilty of all the things they suspect him of, you still got a bigger problem.
Yeah, you've got a bigger, scarier villain right there.
Strange choice, but you could always chalk it up to the LAPD being racist.
That works.
No one's ever gone broke betting on the LAPD being racist.
That explains it. And then they do this extended rooftop fight. They're jumping on top of things and place to place. I definitely got some Cable Guy vibes from that.
Yes, big Cable Guy vibes. The mid-90s were a popular time for fighting on top of a big, you know, satellite dish situation.
And tall catwalks and such. And it didn't help that Sid, for some reason, puts on coveralls with his name tag. He goes Cable Guy.
Cable Guy. Ooh, maybe he was one of the personalities.
Oh, yes. That could explain it.
I actually have the list of all of them somewhere.
Is that a real thing? You really have that?
Hold on. David Koresh, Thomas McCaven, Frederick Cohen, William Bonin, Harvey Glattman, Peter Cooten, William Brian Cruz, Charles Whitmore, Eileen Carol Warnos, Peter Sutcliffe, jeez, Kenneth McDuff, Jesse James, Dr. Glennon Engelman, Harvey Kerrigan, Dr. Giza de Caplani, Norman Selby, Juan Perron, Winnie Ruth Judd, Matthew Grimes, Augusto Pinochet, they have Pinochet on here, Carl Panzram.
You weren't kidding
Abu Nadal,
the political figures, yeah, in this.
Ted Bundy, Wesley Allen Dodd, Roger Dale Stafford. You know those guys are just old school American serial killers who's got, okay, their names. Elizabeth Borden, Lizzie Borden.
Oh, wow.
Mark Essex, Billy the Kid, Lynette Fromm, Larry Eiler, Clem Henderson, David Hendricks, Coral Eugene Watts, William McDonald, Richard Trenton Chase, Siren Siren, Josef Mengele, wow, Ed Kemper, Edward Leonsky, John Collins, Julian Knight, John Hay, Carlton Gary, Vaughn Greenwood, Nikolai Kusko, I'm not sure how to pronounce that one, Randy Kraft, Miguel Rivera, Dean Allen Corley, William Suff, Werner Boost, Terry Paulin, Richard Trenton Chase again?
He came back.
David Burke, Donald Harvey, Vernon Butts, Bruno Hauptmann, Ralph Jerome Sells, John Duffy, Carl Weiss, Gerald Eugene Steno, Benito Mussolini, Paul Calden, Richard Farley, Ian Brady, Joseph Harris, Hirohito, Linwood C. Drake, Saddam Hussein, Gilles de Rais, Herman Mudgett, Donald Nielsen, Robert R. Diaz, Joe Ball, and Adolf Hitler.
Wow. You weren't kidding. I thought you were joking about the Mussolini stuff and the Idi Amin.
Like, no.
They're all in there.
Fucking Pinochet's in there.
Yeah. I think I heard one guy's name. He was the lead singer of Men at Work. There's all kind of interesting characters.
Colin Greenwood.
Mixed into the mix. Somebody did the work to compile that list. I don't know where you found it.
I think that was like IMDb trivia. I should have thrown in some funnier names in there, like the Velociraptors from Jurassic Park.
But talk about missed opportunity. When you read that down, you're like, wow, this movie could have been wild if like all these weird historical characters started popping up in him. But no, it's just like a guy who wants to make music jokes.
Drop Billy the Kid into modern day LA.
Yeah.
What's with these newfangled horse and carriages? I don't know where Billy the Kid actually lived. I assume they didn't have cars.
Who knows? Let me just cap up with the way the movie caps up. We're just talking about how the movie goes from this intellectual pursuit of a serial killer to just gunfire and big knockdown, drag out fights on rooftops. And then it pulls a twist. And I have to admit, it got me. I didn't know what was going on when we jumped back in time and suddenly Sid was winning. And I thought it was clever. They tricked him too. They put him back in the VR. Did you find anything good about that?
At first I was like, are they just doing like the Wayne's World? Like, we can't have that ending. That ending's a bummer. And I was like, that's stupid. But then I realized what they were going for. And I was like, okay, like that's actually clever. I thought that was interesting.
It was one point in the movie where like they got ahead of me and I was like, oh, I get it. Yeah, that's a brilliant way to figure out where young Karen is stashed. And then they do that. And then there's a big come up and scene, which you need, especially in 90s type movies where the heroes finally get to fight back and Dr. Carter shoots Daryl after he kills Chief Billy.
R.I.P. to Billy.
Yeah, we should take a moment for Billy. We did like him more than most people in this movie and he got beaten to death with a wrench. But Dr. Carter shoots him and then Barnes wakes up and William Fichtner runs into the scene just in time to get socked in the jaw, which was like, he was barely in this movie, but because he's a character actor who's known to play the consummate corporate asshole, it just makes perfect sense. You have to punch him out in the climax.
I guess he said like he had a lot more scenes that were cut from the final version. version of the movie that maybe he was like puppeteering some of the stuff behind the scenes, but it just didn't make it.
So yeah.
I think there's probably an explanation somewhere in the cutting room floor for why Denzel was so mad at him, but it is funny. He's like, who here can I punch that would be kind of justified?
Oh yeah, that's the punchable guy that you punch in the third act for being a corporate asshole.
But the cool thing about that little twist they do is that's the first thing that you needed Barnes for, because he was a detective. He's using his brain. Like, everything else is just chasing Sid around from place to place and maybe deducing where he's going to go next. But he shows up on TV anyway. So like, you'd just been there a couple minutes later.
It's kind of obvious. Yeah.
So this is the first time Barnes is kind of using his intellect to like get the upper hand on Sid. Whereas the rest of it could have literally just been Chief Billy running around and Barnes still in jail.
It could have been any of the other 200 cops that Chief Billy said he's put on the case. But yeah, he does something clever. He fully outwits the bad guy. And then because they've been escalating to all this crazy violent action, I guess they decided the very final climax would be really not very action-y. And I was like, oh God, there's 15 minutes left. And it's just him crawling into a silo with young Karen and going, okay, stay put, don't move. There's a pressure plate. Better not move. We're going to have to defuse a bomb.
It's a bit of a Marvel's thing where we don't have a villain anymore. We just have a situation.
Yeah.
Like the villain dies and there's still 20 minutes left.
And they try this thing. This is a slight attempt at ironic meaning in the movie that barely comes through. If you're not watching, you will miss it. But I pointed out to you, it brings to mind the creator, because Barnes, in that initial fight with Grimes, lost his arm. He has actually a cybernetic arm, which they barely show you in the movie. It doesn't play a big role.
It felt like it was supposed to be a bigger thing that they just didn't have time for.
And early on, I only spotted on second watch, there's a moment where Sid calls out, you and me are the same. You know, it's one of those killer cop confrontations. Like, we're the same. We both touch the world through cybernetic arms and we're both accused of killing people or whatever. And then in the end, he uses his cybernetic arm to stop a fan blade so he could crawl into the silo. And then that makes a little opening. He goes, oh, I can pull a little wire out of my cyber arm and use it to defuse a bomb. But for the climactic moment of this action hero, he literally, in the big moment for the hero, goes, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, please, please, please work. And then he plugs a little wire into a slot and it works.
Yeah. Really high octane action stuff happening right there.
Kind of deflating, almost to a point where when I say it, it sounds like I made that line up. He literally said those words in that final scene, and the movie really loses steam in that last 10 minutes.
I think it loses steam in like the last 30 minutes. Even the TV station thing, it was an interesting idea, having him do a live killing spree, but it doesn't really pay off. I'd say like the first two acts of this movie are silly fun, and then the third, when it actually has to wrap it up, it drops the ball a little bit.
We talked about the parts that should be fun not being fun, and the third act definitely loaded with those.
This was 2 full years before we got Russell Crowe in LA Confidential, which I think is when America was really like, oh, this guy's a super good actor. But he is good in this movie. I do think like he's given it the old college try, and like
he is.
He's definitely entertaining. You could tell there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of charisma, maybe just misused in this movie. And then obviously I don't need to tell anyone that Denzel's a good actor.
If the writing was a little better, it could have broken Russell Crowe through more, because obviously he's got the talents. But I don't know. I felt like he's just flailing a lot because the script doesn't quite let him make something meaningful out of his antics.
Yeah, and his character doesn't have a lot of depth, obviously, because he's not a person.
No.
But all right, I'm not going to catch people up on what Denzel and Russell Crowe have been up to, because if you listen to a movie podcast, you probably know. But you want to hear where the more behind the camera people ended up?
I'm curious, yes.
So Brett Leonard, we mentioned The Lawnmower Man. They actually made a sequel to The Lawnmower Man. He didn't, but it's fucking terrible. But so is The Lawnmower Man now, if you watch it.
That's fair.
One thing I've seen from Brett Leonard that I quite liked was the IMAX 3D movie T-Rex Back to the Cretaceous. That was like one of those things that was like always playing in IMAX for a while.
Oh, okay.
They'd be like, people are climbing a mountain. We shot in an IMAX. We're going to play it forever.
Yeah.
And there's a T-Rex. It was like slightly worse graphics than what you would get from Jurassic Park, but on the IMAX screen.
Yeah.
He directed Man-Thing.
Oh.
What was supposed to be a theatrical release, but got pushed to the Sci-Fi Channel.
Interesting.
And his most recent movie was 2021's Triumph, starring Terrence Howard and RJ Mitt, maybe Walter Jr. from Breaking Bad. And it looks like one of those feel good Christian stories, which is a weird place to go for the director of Virtuosity.
Interesting.
And it was written by Eric Berndt. He seems maybe retired. He hasn't written a movie since 2008's The Echo, but he's written some stuff that you've heard of, like Romeo Must Die and Highlander Endgame.
Okay.
I can't speak to the quality of Highlander Endgame, but it's a sequel to Highlander, so it's probably not great.
It's work. I don't know that he's
an honest living.
Yeah. I don't know that he transcended where he got to with Virtuosity, but he managed to stay afloat at that level.
Yeah. And would you like to hear what we're covering next?
Oh, I certainly would. Sometimes I even watch those movies.
Yeah. In 2 weeks' time, we'll be back because now I'm taking a vacation. Ian just took a vacation. Now I'm taking one.
You deserve it.
Going to Portland, Oregon. Very excited. Cool. We'll be covering the Super Mario Brothers movie from the early 90s.
Oh, okay.
I've been dreading this one, but we may have a special guest. Ooh. So that'll be exciting. Yes. We got some special guests coming in the next few months. So stay tuned for that. And thank you guys so much for listening. You can rate, review, subscribe to the podcast.
Please do.
We appreciate it. Follow us on Twitter at BlastZonePod. Email us, BlastZonePod@gmail.com. Love seeing the emails come in from listeners with movie suggestions or feedback.
Yeah,
or whatever.
We've been getting all kinds of helpful stuff from people lately. Love to see it.
Super cool. Love reading them. We respond to them in a timely fashion, typically.
We try.
And that's it. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you in the Blast Zone.
See you next time in the Blast Zone.